How old do you think is the business of banking? Well, let me tell you this. The business of banking is at least 4,000 years old. There are some references to the concept of giving loans, credit, in the ancient texts. One of those ancient texts is the laws of Hammurabi. Right. Hammurabi was a king in Babylon. And number 100 of his code says that the credit has to be well documented. In our own Indian culture, banking is also actually quite old. There are some references to banking or credit in Rig Veda, but they're very innocuous. The earliest reference to the concept of credit is in Jatak tales. Have you heard of Jatak tales?
No, I haven't.
They are basically tales about the prior history of Buddha.
Right.
And they are supposed to date back to roughly 5th or 6th century BCE.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Open Dialogue. In today's episode, we cover a very interesting topic, which is banks and how banks operate. Now, banking obviously is a very old profession, and the origin of the word bank comes from the Italian word banca. And the other anecdote that I found very interesting is that in ancient Italy, merchants would conduct their business in markets but sitting on benches. And if their business went, if they couldn't kind of service their business, then their benches would be broken, or which was also then called banca ruptus. And the word bankruptcy comes from this philosophy, from this term. So today, to discuss this very interesting topic, I have with me Neeraj Gambhir. Neeraj, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Neeraj is group executive at Axis Bank, and he, amongst other things, runs Axis Bank's treasury. And he's a very experienced markets person in India. And we could find no better person to talk on this topic, because essentially when you run treasury or when you run markets, you are trying to kind of run the entire bank, right, by matching the assets and liabilities. So Neeraj, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And look forward to this conversation.
Thank you.
So Neeraj, let me start with some historical perspective of where did banking come from, and you know, when did it start, and what's led us to here.
Very interestingly, you talked about the Italian origin of the word bank, right? But let me ask you this question in return: how old do you think is the business of banking?
At least a few hundred years, maybe going back to the Medici.
The common perception is that it's the Florence,
The Florence
of Medici is where the banking started, right?
Correct.
They were the original most powerful banking family.
Correct.
Well, let me tell you this: the business of banking is at least 4,000 years old.
Wow. Okay.
And there are some references to the concept of giving loans, credit, in the ancient texts. One of those ancient texts is the laws of Hammurabi.
Right.
Hammurabi was a king in Babylon, and number 100 of his code says that the credit has to be well documented, and there are references to his code as to how the debtors are supposed to perform and supposed to return their loans on time, right? And Hammurabi tablets date back to roughly 1750 BC.
Wow.
So that's 3750 years old. In our own Indian culture, banking is also actually quite old. There are some references to banking or credit in Rig Veda, but they're very innocuous. The earliest reference to the concept of credit is in Jatak tales. Have you heard of Jatak tales?
No, I haven't.
They are basically tales about the prior history of Buddha.
Right.
And they are supposed to date back to roughly 5th or 6th century BCE. There is Manusmriti, and in Manusmriti, in chapter 8, it describes in a lot of detail of how a banker or a lender can collect his loan And if the loan is not repaid back, then it is lawful for him to repossess the property or repossess the loan by a variety of means. And there are five means which are described in Manusmriti. So the point that I'm trying to make here is that the business of banking actually dates back to at least 2,500 to 3,000 years. And since then, it has undergone a lot of variations. One big change in the business of banking was in medieval Rome, mm-hmm. when crusades were happening. And I'm sure you would have heard of this concept, this term, Knights Templars. You know, the warrior,
yes.
Folks who were actually going around in the crusades.
Crusades, yeah.
11th century Europe. Knights Templars are supposed to be the original bankers in that sense.
Right.
And from 11th century to 14th century, the Florence, the Italy, where Medici family was there, banking actually flourished quite a lot. The business of banking has been as old as the trade. As long as there has been a need to save and the need to borrow, there has been banking in one form or the other. So the modern history of banking actually starts from 14th century Florence, where Medici family was there. And since then, banking has actually flourished over the last 600 years in a variety of forms. In the meantime, there has been a lot of innovation, a lot of changes in the way the banking business has been conducted. But in its essential form, it has kind of remained same over all these years.
Right. Great, great perspective, Neeraj. Thanks for running through that. In fact, there are, like, I was recently reading this book. It's called Debt, the First 5,000 Years. And in that book, it kind of, the claim is that, and by the way, it references a lot of other historical work done, that actually debt came before money, or debt came before, but the reason to kind of have money was to, you know, legitimize debt versus to do barter. So clearly a very, very old profession. No, thanks a lot for running through that, Neeraj. Now, let's move a little bit onto this, right, which is, look, I mean, at the end of the day, banking facilitates the economy. It does resource allocation, if one may use that word. Banks don't manufacture anything. Banks don't create anything. But despite that, banking is a critical sector in any country. And so much so, if you look at it in India, from a valuation perspective, I think some 30-35% of Nifty is banking stocks. So what makes banking so critical and so valuable?
So it's wrong to say that banks don't create anything. Banks create money. There are two kinds of money, broadly speaking, in an economy. There is the money, which is called the primary liquidity or primary money, which the central bank creates, right, which the Reserve Bank of India creates. Banks take that liquidity and multiply it,
yep,
and convert that into a kind of money which you and I can use.
Right.
You think about this, when we have to go about our ordinary day-to-day lives, we have to buy something, we have to sell something, we operate on the bank accounts that banks provide, right? We don't operate on the money that or the accounts that Reserve Bank has. Reserve Bank doesn't give accounts to ordinary public, it gives accounts to only banks. So effectively, banks take that money and by way of giving credit, they multiply that money and they create the kind of money which is used by an ordinary citizen. And hence, banks are an extended form of what the central bank does. This money, commonly known as M3, because M0 is what is called what Reserve Bank generates, M3 is what banking system creates, is the primary form of credit that goes the wheel, that makes the wheels of the economy go round, right? And therefore, in every aspect of commerce, in every aspect of transactions, there is an involvement of banking. Whatever we do, whatever kind of economic transactions we do, we use banks to settle our payments and we use banks to receive money, right? So that's how essential the business of banking is to the running of a modern economy. Now, modern economy is a money-based economy, right? Money is used as a form of a sort of record keeping, money is used as a unit of value, money is used as a store of wealth, and money is used as a basis of transactions, right? So as long as there is money, there are banks and there is business of banking. That kind of explains to you why banking is considered to be so fundamentally linked to the prospect of an economy.
Yeah. And this this notion of banks creating money, Neeraj, we've covered in our previous episodes. Just to kind of recap a little bit, let's say I have an account, I have a savings account with Bank X, and now I take a loan from Bank X. So now Bank X deposits that 100 rupees into my savings account. So the money in my savings accounts has gone up, and there is a loan account, but you know, just by the act of creating this loan, that Bank X has created money. And so that's the notion of more money being brought into the system by banks. And because they create, you know, at some level, this is, you know, they can just continue to create money. And one of the reasons why banks are so strongly regulated is this. The other one obviously is that if one bank goes bankrupt or out of business, it can just create havoc across the economy and, you know, impact multiple other institutions as well as the core economy as well. Great, very helpful. So if you just take this thinking a little bit forward, what are the tools that, let's say, a central bank uses to ensure that banking is, you know, banks and banking sector remains in good health?
So if you think about this, just as you described, that banks create money by virtue of giving loans,
right?
And if every loan was to translate itself into a deposit,
right,
we can continue to do this loop infinitely.
Yes.
Right? So for every small amount of liquidity injected by the central bank in the economy, banks could actually create an infinite amount of money. And that basically would mean that the banks become infinitely leveraged.
Right.
Right? So we need to have some kind of friction in the whole process. Right? And that friction is generated by the need to maintain reserves with the central bank. So for every rupee or every 100 rupees of deposits that a bank collects, it has to maintain a certain amount, a certain proportion of that deposit as a deposit with the central bank. So what it does is it puts a certain amount of brake on the money creation process, right? So if I give you 100 rupees of loan, you put that back as a deposit with me, then I have to keep, let's say, 4 rupees aside with RBI, and the balance 96 can be lent as a loan.
Right.
So in the second round, the amount of liquidity available to create lending is actually reduced.
Right.
This, in some senses, controls the amount of leverage that the banking system can take collectively. And this form of banking, which is today the prevalent form of banking, is called fractional reserve banking.
Right.
I.e., you are keeping a fraction of the deposits as reserves with the central bank. Right. Now, what do these reserves that are kept with the central bank imply? This is your safety money.
Right.
As a bank. Right. Remember, banking is a business which is deriving its value from law of large numbers. At any point in time, a bank has millions and millions of depositors. All these depositors have kept money with the bank. The assumption is not everybody is going to need their money at the same time, right? Because if they were to, and you can't recall your loans, you will have a crisis, right? So if a certain fraction of depositors were to call back your money or withdraw their deposits with the bank, you have this liquidity sitting with the central bank as your deposit, which you can dip into to pay back those depositors. So effectively, this is one way in which central banks create a safety net, so to say, in the banking system, right? The reserve requirements. The second primary way in which the regulators create a safety net in the banking system is by requiring banks to have a certain proportion of their balance sheet as capital.
Right.
Right? So that's called capital adequacy ratio. So for every 100 rupees of loans that you make, you are supposed to set aside at least 8 rupees, or nowadays banks maintain a larger proportion of capital, so typically about 15 to 16 rupees as capital, right, which can be used in the event of a drawdown on your, well, it's not necessarily a liquidity management tool, but it's more of a risk management
tool,
right? Credit risk management tool.
So just on this, so hence, if a bank gives 100 rupees of loan, then 85 rupees is depositors' money, and 15 rupees is basically shareholders' money.
Shareholders' money. That's right.
And in the case of loans going bad or the bank making losses, the loss is first borne by the shareholders.
That's right.
So let's say between 8 to 15, whatever is the right number, that much of, so let's say up to 15% of loans, if they go bad, the deposit holders are
safe.
You know, safe.
That's right.
The loss is borne by the shareholders.
That's
and
right.
That's what brings in the kind of safety into this entire.
That's right. So that basically provides you the cushion, because banks are ultimately borrowing money to lend money.
Yeah.
Right? So as they are borrowing money to lend money, they're leveraging institutions.
Yep.
Right? So this capital requirement puts a cap on the amount of leverage that you can run in your balance sheet.
Absolutely.
The same concept of fractional reserve, but done in a slightly different way.
Yep.
By requiring capital instead of deposits.
Yep.
Right? So that's the second tool that regulators use to make sure that the business of banking is safe or banks are safe. The third tool, and then you get into several nuances here, is basically, if you think about the business of banking, it's actually taking two or three different kinds of risks. The first kind of risk that we all are very familiar with is the credit risk.
Yep.
Right? I, as a bank, make a loan to someone and the person doesn't pay me back. Right? That's the risk that I'm taking. And that's called credit risk. The second risk that I'm taking is that I have depositors' money on the one hand and I have given money to the borrowers. The maturity of these two is very different. I may have short-term liabilities, short-term depositors' money, and I may have lent this money for a longer period of time. That creates what is called liquidity risk. So the central banks typically, or the regulators typically, impose restrictions on the banks to say how much liquidity risk you can carry in terms of timing mismatches. The third risk is that if you're borrowing short and lending long, we're creating interest rate risk. As the interest rates go up and down, the value of our liabilities and the value of our assets will change, but not in the same form, right? So it creates some risk in the banking system. So regulators impose restrictions on the banks for each of these risk items.
Yep.
The most common notion of restrictions on the banks with regard to credit risk is concentration. Concentration basically means that you cannot lend too much money to one single person, right? You have to make sure that money lent to a single person is within certain limit, a single borrower is within certain limit, and then there is some kind of diversification in your portfolio across the nature of the borrowers, the industries that they belong to, the sectors of the economy that they belong to. So not everything goes wrong at the same time. The restrictions on interest rate risk is basically how much long you can lend versus the maturity of your liabilities, right? And all of these are effectively supposed to collectively work to create a safer bank. Regulatory and supervisory standpoint.
Understood. And again, just to simplify this, let's assume that there is a bank and it has only two customers. There is a depositor and there is a borrower. So just to illustrate the three risks you're talking of, the first risk is that I took the deposit from the depositor, I lent it to the borrower went bankrupt and now he's not able to pay back the money. And so now there is risk because the depositor's money can't be paid back. So this is risk number one. Risk number two is that the depositor has created a deposit, let's say put a 1 year FD, but the borrower has taken a 5 year loan. And at the end of 1 year, I have to return the money back to the depositor. So I need to find one more,
somebody else
to bring in the money.
Give me that deposit.
And now if at that point in time the money is not available, then there is a problem because then, you know, the bank can't honor the depositor's money. So this is the liquidity.
That's the liquidity risk.
That's a liquidity risk. The third one is that the deposit, the 1 year depositor, you know, while I may find somebody else, but maybe the 1 year deposit was created at 7% and the loan was given at, let's say, 7.5%. At the end of 1 year, when the deposit gets renewed, maybe the interest rate was 7.5% already, which means that I am making no money on my loan.
Yeah.
And because of the change in interest rate, my interest rate here is fixed and this has gone up, and that is creating another risk on,
yeah, so
on the bank.
The mismatch between the two sides is creating a earnings risk for me.
For the bank, yeah.
For the bank, yeah.
So that's the interest rate risk. So that's just right. To kind of simplify, yeah, the three risks that you spoke about, and the way the central bank tries to cover for this is, on the first one it says 15 rupees has to be yours. So in reality, there will not be one depositor, there will be many. And you know, there will be not one borrower, there will be many. So up to 15% of borrowers going bad, the depositor is fine. So that's the first way to control.
Well, I'll interrupt you there to say that it's not necessarily 1:1.
Yeah.
The capital that you're required to maintain is a capital that you're required to maintain for all kinds
for
of
all
risks.
For all kinds of risks, sure.
Right? So there
sure.
is an assessment of how much credit risk you're sure. carrying. There is an assessment of how much liquidity risk you're carrying. And there is an assessment of how much interest risk you're carrying.
Yeah.
So the capital is supposed to protect
yeah.
the bank
against
or its
three.
Depositors yeah. against a variety of risks that the bank ends up taking.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
And but the capital itself is not sufficient, right?
Yeah.
Capital is too small as compared to the size of the balance sheet.
Yeah.
And therefore, you have to bring in more
diversification and
more yeah. constraints, yeah. more restrictions on how the business of banking can be done.
Yeah.
So that there is, so the name of the game here is diversification.
Yep.
Remember, banking is a business which runs on law of large numbers.
Yep.
The most popular or the most famous example that people give is that of an theater, and it's raining outside and people are coming in and they all are carrying an umbrella, and because they have to go inside, they have to deposit the umbrella with the guy who's sitting outside the theater. Now this guy suddenly realizes that he has
too many umbrellas.
Quite a few number of umbrellas, and everybody sitting inside the theater is going to be inside the theater for a couple of hours. So what he can do is, because it's raining outside, he can actually lend these umbrellas for a short period of time
yep.
and make some money in the process. But his business model will collapse if everybody was to come out at the same time and ask for their umbrellas back, right? The assumption here is that not everybody is going to come back and ask for the umbrellas back. So that's the thesis. The law of large numbers is at the very core of banking. And in order to make sure that the law of large number operates the way it is supposed to operate, you're going to make sure that the business of banking is diversified. The asset side is diversified, the liability side is diversified.
Absolutely. So, Neeraj, we'll come back to this topic because we'll cover subsequently banking crisis as well. But for now, let's just move on and let's talk a little bit about how banks operate first, right? And let's start with the raw material side, which is the deposits and the liabilities. So, if you can just help us understand various types of liabilities and you know, how they operate and how banks access these.
Yeah, so most common type of liability that you and I operate is a savings bank account.
Yeah.
Right? Different parts of the world have different nomenclature for this, but essentially it is the account that an ordinary individual keeps with the bank for taking care of its day-to-day operating expenses. Right? Now, that's called savings bank account in Indian context. Equivalent of a savings bank account for a corporation or for a business is current accounts.
Yep.
Right? In most of the Western parlance, both of these accounts are called checking accounts because you could use checks
yep.
to withdraw money from these accounts, or you could write checks on them. In Indian context, you pay some interest on savings bank account, but you pay no interest on the current accounts. And both
the
of
bank,
these accounts.
The bank pays no interest on the current account.
To the depositor. And both of these accounts are essentially what is required by the economic agents or people in the economy for their operational purposes. Now, as you earn more than you spend, you will have some balance in your savings account, right? This is the money that you don't require for a short period of time. You could actually do away with this money for some period of time, right? So what do? You basically take this money and keep it as a time deposit or a fixed deposit with the bank in order to earn a better rate of interest, right? Because you're deferring your consumption for some time, you want some return for that, and that's the rate of interest that the bank pays. So that's the third kind of liability that banks run, which is the time deposits or fixed deposits. Nowadays, because there is capital markets, the banks are also allowed to raise some liquidity or some financing through the capital markets by way of bonds. And bonds can be of various forms, right? But the most prevalent bonds that we have is what we call as AT1, Tier 1 bonds. These bonds are basically in the nature of equity. They're a hybrid instrument between equity and debt. And banks can raise some liquidity through these bonds as well. These bonds also count towards the capital of the bank. There is also a variation of them which is called AT2 bonds, Tier 2 bonds. But they are all bonds.
Right.
And similarly, in India, banks are allowed to issue infrastructure bonds. These are all basically market borrowings that you can use to fund your liability side of the business. Third variety of instrument is money market borrowings. These are very short-term borrowings that banks borrow in the money, that banks use in the money market. Typical examples are certificates of deposit. Certificate of deposit are another form of deposit which are issued in the form of certificates which can be traded. And these are typically issued to institutional investors like mutual funds, insurance companies, you know, corporates, etc. Or you could also pledge your own holdings of securities in the market to raise some liquidity by way of what is called repos, right? Repurchase agreements. So these are various forms of liabilities that a bank has access to in order to fund the assets. And on the asset side, you are largely talking about loans, right?
Right. So Neeraj, let's take one hypothetical example, which I'm sure for you is a very frequent occurrence, which is, you know, Axis Bank is taking deposits daily and making loans daily. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, some corporate takes a large loan, let's say 20 crores or 30 crores. And you find out that you do not have enough deposits. So now what do you do?
Well, you can borrow in the market.
Right.
There is a money market. This money market is consisting of institutions and banks and mutual funds like us. And you can step into the market and say, hey, I need 20 crores for a day. Hopefully by tomorrow I'll get my deposit and then I'll repay this back to you.
Right.
Right. You could raise this. So this is purely simple call borrowing, as we call it. Right. Right?
And this you will raise either from another bank or from a mutual fund.
Yeah.
Or maybe there are some other institutions which are.
So there are, you know, insurance companies who could be participating here, etc. The other thing is that you can issue what is called a certificate of deposit,
right,
which is again subscribed to by the institutional investors. Certificate of deposits are typically longer term, going up to 1 year, right? So effectively, if you don't have the deposit at the time when you're making the loan, you have certain tools available with you with which you can actually bridge this gap.
Right.
Between your advances and your deposits for a short period of time.
Right.
But eventually, you got to make sure that your deposits grow.
Of course.
Because if the deposits don't grow, these borrowings are not going to help you to continue to do business.
Yeah. These are short-term adjustments.
These are basically, in some senses, these are the borrowings that you can do to
manage
to take care of short-term mismatches in your balance sheet.
Yeah. Right? And also, you could go to the central bank.
Well, typically you go to the central bank and you go to the central bank for raising again short-term liquidity. Most of the time, central banks requires collateral.
Right.
Right? They will not give you collateral-free liquidity. Very rarely central banks give you collateral-free liquidity. When you say collateral is required, typically they will ask for government securities as collateral, which means that you should have had invested before. You should have been holding some government bonds in your hands before you go to the central bank to raise for this liquidity. So again, access of central bank facilities is just a temporary tool, right? It helps you bridge over your mismatches, but it cannot be used to continuously finance your balance sheet.
Great. So now this brings me to the next question, Neeraj, which is, in the way you spoke about it, there are certain deposits which have maybe slightly different characteristics from a long-term, quote-unquote, nature or stable nature and maybe more desirable compared to certain other types of liabilities. And there are these lots of three-letter acronyms you hear, right? LCR and NSFR and so on and so forth. So could you throw some light on that? Like what deposits are good, what deposits are maybe not so great and so on?
So these nomenclatures of LCR, which is called liquidity coverage ratio, NSFR stands for net stable funding ratio, are basically tools or requirements by the central banks to ensure that your balance sheet is stable.
Yep.
It is funded by stable sources of liquidity.
Yep.
Now, in the aftermath of global financial crisis in 2008, the one realization that happened was not all deposits are equal. From a balance sheet management perspective. there are certain deposits which have the tendency to go out faster in the event of a stress. There are certain deposits which are inherently quite stable because A, they are diversified, granular, B, they're not basically the first ones to leave the door if something was to go wrong. So basis this characteristics of deposits, different levels of reserves are required to manage these deposits, right? So for example, if I raise money from you, Samir, as a deposit, it's less likely, it's not unlikely, but it is less likely that you will be the first one to withdraw a deposit in the event of a stress scenario. Therefore, the amount of liquidity that I need to maintain against that deposit is lower as compared to if I were to raise the deposit from a let's say a financial institution who is very likely to withdraw the money the moment some stress scenario arises, right? So both of these deposits have different characteristics of a stability perspective. And in the aftermath of global financial crisis, Basel, which is basically the global platform or global sort of conglomeration of central banks, came up with certain rules. And those rules are basically LCR and NSFR rules, which effectively ask banks to maintain higher reserves or higher liquidity for unstable deposits or less stable deposits and lesser reserves for stable deposits. And a combination of these two determines how you as a bank run your balance sheet, right? A similar treatment is given under NSFR regime, where you look at stability of the deposits from a stable funding perspective. So both of these are tools, both of these are requirements from a supervisory regulatory standpoint to make sure that the learnings of global financial crisis are embedded in the way now banks manage their balance sheet.
So in just to kind of on this, if let's say a retail customer opens a savings account, typically if it's a salaried customer, then you know every month there is a salary, then the guy has a certain set of bills to pay. And so, you know, you could almost predict that first of the month, this is the credit that will come, then second of the month, electricity bill, third month, this bill, fourth month, this bill, and so on and so forth. And you see this happening month after month after month after month. And maybe the person once in a while will invest, or maybe they will get some, you know, one-time, let's say their redemptions they will do and they'll get one-time flow in. But in general, you will find a very stable behavior of the savings account. Contrast that to the financial institution you mentioned, let's say a mutual fund or somebody who's operating a current account. Maybe one day lots of investors subscribe into the mutual fund, suddenly there is large flows, and then you know the next day they invest, so the money goes out. Maybe one day there were lots of redemptions, and you know, so it's very difficult to find a stable pattern. And so, and also the point you mentioned that the retail investor is less likely to pull out all his money, whereas the mutual fund may be the first one to kind of pull out their money. And so these two are thought of differently. And these, the first one is considered more stable, the second one is considered less stable. So second one, you have to keep more reserves, the first one you keep less reserves. So as a bank, you would find the retail savings account or the small business current account or the retail FD more quote-unquote long-term and desirable liability. Would that be a...
No, that's a fair characterization. The only thing that I would like to add to that is to say that, remember, and we, you know, in the early part of this conversation, we said that banking as a business is all about diversification.
Right.
Right. When a lot of your deposits are coming from retail, this is a lot of individuals placing small deposits with the bank to add up to a certain amount. Right. Whereas from an institutional investor, you'll typically get a bulky amount.
Right.
Right. And which can create more swings in your balance sheet as compared to the same amount raised through retail investors. So not just the propensity to withdraw, but also the absolute volatility of these two deposit bases is also what goes to say what is more desirable and what is less desirable.
Right. Understood.
And hence, you know, clearly in today's paradigm of banking, raising deposits from individual retail investors or smaller investors is considered to be the best form of liability as against, let's say, raising money from institutions, corporates, etc.
Right. And that, Neeraj, also probably turns, also kind of translates to the cost of the deposit, which is raw material for the bank. Would certain deposits be quote unquote cheaper compared to certain other deposits? And
yeah, so if you know, if I have two kinds of deposits, one is more desirable from a regulatory perspective, the second is less desirable, I would tend to price those deposits differently, right? And therefore I would like to pay less for the less desirable deposits and I'd like to pay more for the more desirable deposits. That's generally the state of affairs as far as pricing of or the interest rates on deposits is concerned. But at times you do have market dynamics come into play, and you do find that wholesale bulk deposits tend to attract higher price than what you're willing to pay on the retail deposit. But that's, there can be these short-term misalignments and aberrations in the market.
Right.
In general, as a bank, you should pay better for more stable deposits.
Right, understood. And so just to again put that into perspective, on the current account, the bank pays zero. On the savings account, the bank doesn't pay zero, but it pays a lower amount compared to fixed deposits. So let's say most Indian banks today would pay
between 3.5 to 4%.
So let's, for simplicity, let's just say 3.5%. So zero, 3.5. Fixed deposit rates today, 1 year FD will be in the 6.5, 7.5% kind of a range. And maybe the bulk deposit will get slightly higher than the 7.5, or it will be around the 7.5%.
Well, ideally the bulk deposit should be somewhat lesser than what you pay for the retail.
Right.
But remember, when you think about retail deposits, you also have to take into account the fact that collecting retail deposits is an operationally expensive process. You've got to have so many branches, you've got to have back-end infrastructure to take care of it, etc., etc. So when you adjust for the operating cost, sometimes you may end up paying a little more for the bulk deposits as compared to the retail deposits. But the pricing of these deposits, in some senses, is also a function of what's the liquidity in the system. You know, how much is the competition amongst the banks to raise these deposits? If the economy is doing well, there is a lot of demand for credit, then banks don't mind paying a little extra for a larger amount of money so that they can extend more credit, and that then tends to price the bulk deposits a bit higher. But in theory, I think ideally the granular diversified retail deposit book should get the best pricing out.
Yeah. And so now if you just kind of think of two, again, conceptual exercise, but we think of two banks. One has a higher proportion of current and savings accounts compared to the other. So would it be right to say that just this bank has some advantage because for offering the same loan, this bank will make better margins compared with the second bank?
Yeah. So look, banking is the business of intermediation. We are borrowing money and we are lending money. And the difference between the two, what is called spread, is what we earn, right? So if we can source cheaper money, we'll make more spread. And as you just mentioned, current and savings account carry lower rates of interest than term deposits. So if my liabilities have more of current and savings accounts, my cost of funding as a bank is going to be lower than someone who doesn't, for example, have current and savings accounts, right? And therefore, my margin for the same loan would be a lot better than a bank which does not have the same construct of the liabilities. That is why having a fair share of what is called CASA deposits in your liability base is absolutely essential for banks to maintain their profitability.
And which is why when we talk of, analysts talk about banks, they focus a lot on this CASA ratio, great, very helpful. One final thing on the liability side, Neeraj, before we move on, which is this, there is this notion, and particularly now, that because people are investing into other asset classes, let's say mutual fund SIPs or equities and so on and so forth, so money is going out of banking system and banks. So just will be helpful to get your perspective on this.
Yeah, money doesn't go out of the banking system.
Right.
Right. Money stays in the banking system.
Right.
So let's take an example. You have a savings bank account.
Yep.
And you have a certain balance in the savings bank account. What and now you want to invest. You have two options. One is that you can do a fixed deposit with the bank. Second, you can buy a mutual fund unit with the, you know, with that money. And let's walk through both of these examples. When you keep the deposit with the bank out of that savings bank account, your balance in savings bank account goes down and your term deposit goes up.
Yeah.
But it's the same. It stays with us. Yeah. In
it
the
has
bank.
Become slightly more expensive for the bank.
That's right.
But the money is the same.
But deposit stays
the
there.
Same. Yeah.
Right? Now, when you use that money to buy a mutual fund unit, you will typically write a check or do a bank transfer, right? So the mutual fund has gotten the money. What will the mutual fund do? It will take that money and put it in its current account with us and with the bank, right? And then it will find an investment which it finds worthy of making an investment in, and it will write a check or it will make a bank transfer to buy that security. Now somebody is selling the security. So money goes from this mutual fund's account to whosoever is selling the security to the mutual fund in their bank account. Now, for example, let's say this seller of the security was a corporate who is issuing a new security. What is the corporate going to do with that money? It is going to use that money to pay for its raw materials, to pay for its salaries.
Yep.
So money goes from the corporate's current account into the individuals who are getting paid the salary, which could very well be you.
Yep.
In your bank account. So look, a lot of transactions are happening in this process, but money does not leave the banking system. What does happen is a change in the characteristic of money. What was basically a savings bank deposit converted into a current account balance of a mutual fund, converted into a current account balance of a corporate, converted into a current account balance of a vendor of a corporate, converted into again a savings bank deposit of the employee of the vendor when he made the payment using this money. But the money keeps on circulating within the banking system. So therefore, your subscription or your diversification of your investment away from bank deposits to mutual funds does not affect the level of deposits in the banking system, right? Money does not leave the banks. And which is, I started with this, only banks create money. Mutual funds don't create money.
Correct.
Right? Only banks can create money, and you do need banking system to make this money go around. Right? And therefore, what determines the level of deposits in the banking system is the stuff that we talked about. How much are you allowed to lend for every 100 rupees of deposits, i.e. reserve ratio requirements, your capital requirements, other constraints that the regulator puts on you. It could so happen as this money is doing its hops in the economy, the proportion between savings deposits, current account deposits, term deposits,
could keep on changing
over a period of time.
Yeah. So great. I think this is again very, very insightful, and I would say kind of a little bit contrary to popular belief, right? And so if I were to summarize what you said, Neeraj, and now I'm adding a few of my own thoughts into this. There are only three ways in which money can leave the banking system. Number one is that banks' balance sheet contrasts. So, so loans get paid back and banks are not making new loans. So, you know, so that is one. Second is the central bank takes money out.
Central bank could ask you to keep more reserves, or take the money out.
Either through keeping more reserves or they are selling bonds or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But central bank is taking money out. Or third is that bank money gets printed into currency notes.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that, but yes,
exactly.
That's the third
way. That's a third way. There are only three, because currency note in my wallet is not in the banking system.
That's right.
So that can't be used for any of this. But these are only three ways in which money can kind of go out of the banking system. And that now brings me to my next question, which is for the last, I would say many quarters actually, in India, the deposit growth rate has been lower compared to the credit growth rate, and by a bit, right? Like by 3-4 percentage points. So what is, if money, if you know, the act of creating loans is creating money, then the growth rate of deposits should be the same as the growth rate of loans. But for consistently for, I would say like 4-6 odd quarters, credit growth is ahead of deposit growth. So what's driving this?
So there are many factors at play here. One is that when you give credit to someone, if that person does not spend, right, the hops of the money don't happen in the system. So it depends upon how that money is being used in some senses. So that's one variable which determines the amount of multiplication that is happening in the system. The second is, like we described, that the primary producer of money in the system is central bank,
yeah.
Right? They are the ones who have the monopoly over producing money. We just multiply it. We just create a beta factor on top of it. So if the central bank is keeping the system tight in terms of liquidity, it tends to have an effect on how much deposit rates will, and this has been empirically tested,
yep.
Right? That amongst the driver of deposit growth in an economy, the most important driver is the liquidity or the stance of liquidity by the central bank, right? Credit creation to some extent, and the other thing that happens is that while we may say that credit is growing faster than deposits, but at the end of the day, the bank's balance sheets have to balance.
Yep.
I cannot create credit if I don't have a matching liability.
Yeah.
Now, it might so happen that liability is not coming through
deposits.
Deposits. Yeah. It could be coming through bonds.
Yep.
It could be coming through some other sources that I may have. I could be borrowing abroad. So there are so many ways in which you can actually balance this balance sheet and yet have a credit growth while the deposit growth is not consistent with that. But I think the single most important driver in my mind is the liquidity stance by the central bank, which tends to have a lagged effect on how the deposit growth is doing.
Fantastic. I think we'll come back to this topic again, because we'll also speak about this interest, money transmission, interest rate transmission, liquidity management, etc. That brings us to the end of this episode. Today we spoke about banks, how they operate. We focused on how banks create money, how regulators think about controlling the risks that banks undertake. We also spoke about different types of liabilities, current accounts, savings accounts, fixed deposits, and their characteristics. And we also covered how money in the banking system remains within the banking system. It was a fantastic conversation. We hope you liked it as much as we liked bringing it to you. Thank you for watching.